And welcome to She Thinks, a podcast where you're allowed to think for yourself. I'm your host, Beverly Hallberg. And on today's episode, Dr. Eric Kaufman joins us to talk about the rise in mental health problems, the rise in wokeness, and if there's a connection. He's going to answer the question, do progressive ideas make people unhappy, or are unhappy people drawn to the cultural left? So we're going to review the data behind the mental health crisis, the research that looks into why it's occurring, and how wokeness is either a cause or an effect. And as we bring him on, a little bit more about Dr. Eric Kaufman. He is a professor of politics at the University of Buckingham, where he directs the Center for Heterodox Social Science. He's written many books and papers on national identity, the cultural left, and political demography. And his latest book is entitled Taboo, How Making Race Sacred Produced a Cultural Revolution. Dr. Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us on She Thinks.
Thanks for having me, Beverly.
And before we jump into what came first, the chicken or the egg, is it mental health or is it wokeness? I just want to dive into your research a little bit more and your background. How did you end up making research on cultural politics your life's work? Was that what you set out to do at a young age? Did you say that this is what I want to be when I grow up?
No, definitely not, Beverly. I mean, it was a bit accidental, me coming into academia anyway. I had no intention of doing it until quite late, and just was in doing a PhD for interest, and then eventually thought, oh yeah, I guess this is what you do with these things, is go into academia. And so that happened. And I was always interested in politics of culture, you know, questions, immigration, national identity, a lot of the questions that are very live in the US and Europe today, but also this issue of the cultural left, which I think is very important. The evolution of these not economic left Marxist ideas, but more the cultural left ideas, which go into critical theory and the new left. That was something I have had a long-standing interest in. And I think what we're seeing is just the intensification of those ideas. And they've acquired more power than they had in the past.
And even within your background, I found it interesting to show you were, I believe, born in Tokyo. You lived there for a while, then moved to Canada. You were a tenured professor there, decided to leave. You're now in the UK. Tell us a little bit about just living in different countries, what that has taught you, and why you decided to leave your tenured position.
Well, yeah, I have got a very kind of international background. My dad was in the Canadian embassy and then in various businesses that were between Japan and Canada. So I've spent eight early years of my life in Tokyo. And then I grew up in Vancouver and then have been in London for over 25 years now as an academic. Now, just in terms of the what's been happening on campuses, which many of your viewers or listeners will be no strangers to, will be this idea of cancel culture. People are becoming increasingly intolerant of ideas they don't like, particularly if those are coming from what they consider people who are conservative or even classical liberal. Starting in about 2018, we had a new staff member who was the youngest staff member. I was head of department. She was what you might call a social justice warrior, and sort of made it her goal in life to try and sort of go after me and anyone else who she thought was on the wrong side of her self-righteous belief system, which is very black and white, of course, totalizing. That was one individual who, and there were other individuals who sort of were causing trouble. So I had open letters, I had Twitter mobbings, they prompted internal investigations, including kangaroo courts, and they keep you on edge. So I had a number of these internal investigations, probably about four of them, just for social media activity, because I was sort of pretty open in my criticism of the social justice movement. Of course, criticizing a movement badged as, say, anti-racist, the immediate charge is you're a racist, but, you know, this is the kind of dishonesty that one deals with. So that was kind of going on for the past few years. What I then have done is moved to Britain's only kind of relatively free speech kind of university called Buckingham, where I'm trying to build this new Center for Heterodox Social Science. And you can do things. So I'm teaching a course on woke, for example, 15 weeks, open online course. Anybody, including your listeners, can actually sign up. That's the kind of thing that's not possible to do in a normal mainstream university.
Was it hard for you to leave a tenured position? I mean, you're leaving security, you're leaving what you know. What was that decision like for you?
Well, it was a difficult decision, and it took a number of years for me to eventually decide to go, because you are in a kind of fireproof situation where you've accrued quite a few privileges, and it's a very secure living. It's a, you know, relatively prestigious university. And I just thought, well, if I'm ever going to move, it's got to be now, because, you know, this is really unsatisfactory. They were starting to, what I feared was they were then going to start to censor my research and not let me proceed by controlling what's called ethics approval processes. It's all political, and so or it's susceptible to political corruption. So just this corruption is creeping through, and I just thought it was time to leave.
There's another famous professor from Canada who has talked about this. That's Jordan Peterson. Right. I'm assuming you guys have been in touch and talk about your similar experiences.
Yeah, I've met him on a few occasions around the academic freedom issue, and I'm going to be on his podcast when my book comes out in May. It's actually in the U.S. It'll be called The Third Awakening, so it'll come out in mid-May. Yeah, I think we're very much working together. And of course, Canada is probably one of the worst places for this stuff. The U.S. has more checks. It's got a somewhat more diverse media. We have some counterweights and politically as well, whereas in Canada, it's much more grim than that. So he's been a key voice, just speaking up against what you might call progressive illiberalism. Because what is this thing called woke? One sentence definition: it's making sacred historically marginalized race, gender, and sexual minority groups. So these are seen as sacred groups. If you say anything that offends a hypothetically most sensitive member of such a group, by saying, for example, mispronouncing somebody's surname or saying that anybody can make it in America, you know, these can be termed microaggressions, and you can be seen as kind of a racist or whatever, or a transphobe. And that can sort of essentially damage or even smear your reputation and your career and so on. So it's a deeply illiberal, it's against the pursuit of truth, it's against the Enlightenment, and it's against many things. There are more people now that are starting to see the damage. And of course, it all travels under these flags of convenience called inclusion, diversity, anti-racism. How can you be against these things? But of course, the underbelly of these things is highly authoritarian. So, for example, just a couple of examples might be diversity. The underbelly of that nice sounding word is essentially anti-white or anti-male discrimination or anti-Asian discrimination. Inclusion sounds very good. The underbelly of that is essentially speech suppression and speech policing. So, I mean, they will hide that bit and present you the nice face. And a lot of people are sort of fooled by the label on the tin rather than opening up the tin and seeing what's inside.
So as we open up the tin, you gave a description of what wokeness is. I want to talk about how it's increased in the past decade before we get into the mental health connection to it. And so you already started with, I think, two main areas, which is Canada has seen an increase more than the United States has, but the United States is very quickly following in its footsteps, but also academia. Academia is where we saw this wokeness began. Why did it begin? Where are we today? How pervasive is it into all aspects of culture?
It's extremely pervasive. What you should imagine, it's a bit like a virus, like COVID. It metastasized within universities from sort of the late 1960s to the 2000s. And then in the 2010s, social media and the new model of media, which was based on clicks rather than classified ads, meant that even outlets like the New York Times had to go for stirring up emotions and driving social media virality. So all of that just allowed these bad ideas to surge off campus and into the wider elite culture and the youth culture and corporations and foundations. And that's how it made it into the youth culture in a big way, whereas prior to that, it had been less prominent. But it's important to note that these ideas really, like critical race theory, goes back to the Black Panthers in the late 60s were saying that the U.S. Constitution was a cover for slavery. And these sorts of, that is really the basis for critical legal studies in the 70s and critical race theory in the 80s. And so all of these things were, and radical feminism, all queer theory, all of this was really being talked about and written about in a lot of sections of academia. But political correctness, which I experienced in the early 1990s at tells you about my age, but that was sort of something that was emerging in the early 90s. And I think it sort of went, it didn't go away. It just sort of became institutionalized in speech codes. And then it just burst again in the 2010s in this, what some have called the Great Awakening. So those ideas have a long history, but it's the off-campus surge that's due to social media and the new media.
Absolutely. And what's interesting about this is this has coincided with the rise in mental health issues. Let's just dissect the mental health issue crisis first. How bad is it? We hear about it. Is it really happening? Is it just that there's more a spotlight on it? What is your take on it? I know that's not your specific area of research, but it has coincided with what you do research.
Well, just in terms of some numbers that from the latest Foundation and Individual Rights and Expression survey, it's a massive survey, 55,000 U.S. college students, 7 in 10 of them say they are anxious at least half the time. So we're talking about an epidemic. Now, depressed, that it's at least 40% depressed at least half the time. You know, these numbers are sort of 2 to 3 times higher than amongst adults. So we have a huge youth mental health issue, and it's not just them over-reporting. We've seen sort of 2 to 3 times higher levels of people being admitted to hospital for cutting themselves. We've seen suicide rates up. Girls have experienced this more than boys, but the rates have gone up for both. I mean, Jonathan Haidt's new book, Anxious Generation, Abigail Schreier's book, Bad Therapy, both talk about this mental health crisis. It's also in Britain, it's in Canada and Australia and all the Anglosphere countries, it's in Western Europe. So there is definitely an increase that is very noticeable, and it is a crisis. So the question then is, well, you know, what has caused this? Now, at the same, because what's tricky is you can see these mental health indicators, self-harming, suicide, anxiety, all of these things surging in the mid-2010s, and you see no platformings, cancelings, the number of times the media uses words like white privilege, white supremacy, all of those transphobia, all of that is surging in the mid-2010s. So it all is happening at the same time. And the puzzle is, well, what is causing what? Is it that the mental health leads people to essentially see themselves as victims and therefore sympathize with victim groups or so-called victim groups? And is that what's driving it? Or is it that this whole ideology makes people look to themselves as victims and therefore causes the mental health crisis?
Well, you mentioned in a recent piece that you published on Unheard, and that's entitled The Mental Health Crisis Does Not Explain Wokeness. You talk about a study from Finland that discovered that woke individuals are more likely to be unhappy, anxious, depressed than other people. So what is the connection that this study from Finland is making, and what is your own conclusion on this? What causes what?
Well, yeah, so we have now quite a bit of data that shows that people who are very liberal or left are considerably more sad and anxious than those who are in the center, but certainly compared to conservatives. They're a lot less happy, a lot more depressed and anxious. And this finding from Finland just takes that finding a little bit further and says, well, it's not the economic left attitudes, say redistributing wealth, that's really driving this, but it's the cultural left attitudes around woke, it's wanting to shut down harmful speech, for example. That is really what's heavily connected to being less happy. So that's the study from Finland. And then there's this new data, I mean, the data from FIRE, which I then said, well, okay, this is interesting. FIRE's now include 5 questions on mental health of students, and we can look at students on the FIRE, you know, very liberal students and very conservative students. You know, we've got very liberal students who have mental health problems, which is the majority, but we also have some that don't have as severe mental health, but are still on the very liberal end of the spectrum. Let's compare those two groups. That is very liberal people who have mental health problems. Again, it's vast majority, but there's a certain minority that don't have severe mental health problems. And what you see is actually, there isn't that much difference. If we take a question like, is it okay to shout down a speaker that you don't like? Is it, or should you prevent somebody from coming onto campus who says abortion should be banned? You know, the kind of people that would give the cancel culture response on both of those occasions, if they are very liberal, they're much more likely to want to cancel. if they have anxiety, they're slightly more likely to want to cancel, but they're not vastly more likely than someone who doesn't have anxiety to want to cancel. So if we're comparing the impact of being very liberal to very conservative versus being very anxious and not very anxious, it's much of the action is in that ideology. So if you're very conservative, you're much less pro-cancel culture than if you're very liberal, whereas the mental health doesn't seem to matter as much. And in a way, what's interesting there is it suggests that it's not the mental health that's driving this, but it's the ideology. And that kind of leads us into a very different place. So it leads us to say, maybe what this therefore means is we had the rise of this cultural left woke ideology, and that's what sort of drove people towards, on the one hand, perhaps, mental health issues. I mean, smartphones as well are having an impact.
Sure.
But it's really, if we want to express, if we want to explore the rise of cancel culture, you know, the targeting of professors for firing campaign, that is much more linked to ideology, and it's not as linked to people who happen to be have worse mental health, maybe because they're on their phones too much and maybe they're not getting enough sleep and they're not going outside. And all those things are real. But in terms of explaining woke and the surge in woke amongst young people, that really seems to be coming out of programming that they're getting, whether that's in school, whether that's online, that's really what's driving it.
We'll use that example of shouting down a speaker, but as we look at the liberal ideology, there are so many different factors to it, but it definitely has the underpinnings, which you said earlier, of this victimhood, that there are oppressed groups. Do you feel that part of the anxiety is because this ideology makes you think that everybody is being harmed in some way and that there's more of an onus on a person to take it upon themselves to fix that? Is that part of the ideology? Where is the pressure point from the ideology for a young person to lead to the anxiety and depression?
Well, I think there's two things going on with this ideology of the cultural left. It encourages you to be different, always be different. There's social cachet in being different. So maybe you want to not identify as a boy or a girl, but something else. Maybe you want to identify as not heterosexual, because being heterosexual is conforming in some way. So, I mean, along with this rise in mental health problems, we also see another thing, which is a surge in LGBT identification. And in some of these surveys, we're getting 25-30% of people under 30 identifying as LGBT. So that's happening at the same time. And I think it's all part of this thrust. You've got to be different, but at the same time, you also have to identify as part of an oppressed and victimized group. That also is what's valued by this ideology. The ideology values weakness being an oppressed group and it attacks groups that are seen as oppressors, whether that's, you know, whites or males or Jews or whoever, heterosexuals, whoever's the oppressor group is to be attacked, and whoever is the oppressed group, that's where the virtue lies. So people are kind of herding towards what they're encouraged to see as virtuous identities. So I think the net result of this, it expresses itself in different ways. I mean, one is you can say I'm victimized because I'm trans or I'm LGBT. If you don't happen to be a minority ethnically, that's a place you can go. So I think what that then does is, once you are identifying as LGBT, even if you're not, and all the data would suggest the actual same-sex behavior hasn't changed much. It's just this LGBT identification. And those people who choose that actually have much worse mental health. And I think it's something destabilizing about sort of wanting to go and be something that's other than the norm, to be abnormal. That's great in a way, according to this ideology, but it also kind of leaves you without a secure identity. And I think it's that insecurity of identity and role that is sort of destabilizing for these people.
And it becomes your primary identity instead of the things that you do or your skill set or a wide number of factors. It becomes how you identify yourself and how you're part of a victim class instead of other things. And I think that plays into this whole idea of whether or not we are teaching young people or telling young people to be resilient, to have grit, that no matter what happens to you in life, to overcome. And what would you say about just the social science behind that all? If we teach people to be victims versus overcomers, what does that change about somebody's mental health?
Well, I think Jonathan Haidt and Abigail Schreier talk a lot about this, is if you think that you don't have control of your own life, but other forces, so-called structures, whether those be racial or patriarchal or whatever, are in control of you, then a lot of studies show that that makes you less successful and more depressed. People need to feel that the choices they make, that they have agency. And if you keep telling people that you know, no, it's white people will never let you get ahead, patriarchy will never let you get ahead, you know, heterosexuals won't let you get ahead, I mean, then you'll feel hopeless about yourself. So I think that's an extremely negative message, I mean, in terms of mental health, whereas actually resilience is much more important. What's happened, I think, is Schreier talks about in the therapy industry, is that they've totally gone for these affirming sort of, you know, a victimhood culture, a vulnerability mentality that essentially always affirms your feelings. You know, if you feel like you're a boy, if you feel like you're depressed, if you feel anything, then that's got to be sort of affirmed. Whereas I think the sort of more stoic, some of the older CBT type therapies would say, well, no, you've actually got to be strong. You've actually got to control your thoughts. You've actually got to push back on some of these things and not just kind of affirm weakness. And those have become unfashionable in a way because they're seen as going against that left-wing narrative of always extolling the virtues of weakness as against the strong. And so I think it's all part of a package that leads to worse mental health and also leads to some of these ideological phenomena like the awakening that we see.
And so I think the question so many people ask is, as we are in this trajectory, it's not getting better, what do we do about it? I think especially parents out there who send their kids to public schools, but it's on all of culture and society. This is pervasive, as we were saying earlier. What is the way to fight against it? Of course, you're doing that in your work, and there are a lot of people who are talking about it, but it seems so widespread almost that it's hard to overcome it.
Yeah, it is. I think people have to do whatever they can privately. You know, if you know of a decent school, in your area and you have the choice to go, that would be one place to send your kids. But I think the bigger thing, because a lot of the data would suggest that even in, private schools are not that different from public schools, are not even that different from homeschooling, believe it or not. I think the school reform movement that's going on in states like Florida and Texas, that's very important, that in a way, this political activism that's going on in the classroom has to be brought to an end through a combination of legislation and regulation. And there are some people who are libertarian and think, oh, no, you can't use the government. I disagree with that. I actually think most kids are going to go through the public school system. We have to get the ideology out of that system. And also the therapeuticization, you know, the constant saying that, you know, have you checked up on your thoughts and feelings? As Schreier says, we've got to dial that back a lot. And yes, if someone is really in trouble, they can go to a teacher who can refer them onto a professional. But this idea that you want to avoid, you know, introducing people who have mild sadness or anxiety, that's just normally a normal part of life. You don't want to medicalize that and push them down a track where they then start actually to have real psychological problems. So I just think there's a lot of reform that needs to be done in the schools. The only real way that happens, I'm afraid, is governments taking on the educational establishment and the unions, getting them to understand that in a democracy, they do not get to control the curriculum. They do not get to control and introduce politics in the curriculum. Even in a place like Britain, where I live now, where it's against the law to have political indoctrination in class, but teachers are still doing it because they would say that critical race and gender and queer theory isn't political because they're not talking about the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. Well, we know that's a dodge. These are political issues, but it's up to the government to actually define in very precise terms what is and isn't political, how you can teach certain subjects. And I think that's really the only way forward.
And final question for you, I'm just curious, based on your research, do you think that the majority of parents, regardless of what country they live in, would be for schooling just to be for learning how to read, to write, to learn history, versus these more political cultural ideas like DEI and critical race theory? Do you think most parents are on board with getting rid of that side of the curriculum that is so prevalent?
I think they absolutely are. I mean, I've done surveys in the US, Canada, and Britain. They all more or less say the same thing, you know, that parents are overwhelmingly against teaching of race and gender theory. I mean, we can just pick a few questions on that. You know, for example, teaching that there is no such thing as biological sex, only your chosen gender. That's opposed 85 to 15 in all three countries. That's just one example. I mean, again, teaching kids that the US is a racist country built on stolen land, that's overwhelmingly, I mean, it's overwhelmingly opposed by parents and not just Republicans. So I just think there needs to be a translation of the public will into the classroom much more than exists at present. And that's going to require stamina to face down the entrenched interests that want to continue to pursue indoctrination.
And that's why your recent book that people can get is so important in the United States. It's called The Third Awakening, a 12-point plan for rolling back progressive extremism, an important book, especially for parents. Dr. Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at the University of Buckingham, thank you so much for joining us on She Thinks.
Thanks, Beverly.
And thank you all for joining us. Before you go, IWF does want you to know that we rely on the generosity of supporters like you. An investment in IWF fuels our efforts to enhance freedom, opportunity, and well-being for all Americans. So please consider making a small donation to IWF by visiting iwf.org/donate. That is iwf.org/donate. Last, if you enjoyed this episode of She Thinks, do leave us a rating or a review. It does help. And we love it if you shared this episode so your friends can know where they can find more She Thinks. From all of us here at IWF, thanks for watching.